Please join me in the book of Judges, chapter number 1, where we will pick up our story in verse 31 in just one moment. First, let me remind you that there is some overlap between the book of Joshua, the final few chapters, and the beginning of the book of Judges in the first couple of chapters. We're looking, I believe, at a time right after the first seven-year period that Israel was in the land. Those first 6 years was spent in Joshua clearing those 30-something fortified cities of Canaanites and really just setting the stage for what was supposed to happen next, which was after they allotted the tribal territories that happened in the seventh year that they were in the land during the year of rest, the Israelis, tribe by tribe, were supposed to start taking their territory over, occupying it, and keeping the Canaanites out. But that's not what happened. It would appear that after the year of rest, which ran from 1410 BC in the fall until the fall of 1409 BC, that's my calculations, the Israelis began compromising with many of the Canaanites. The Canaanites had come back into the territory they'd run away from, been chased out of, and even started rebuilding and refortifying some of the cities. And chapter 1 of the book of Judges records some of that compromise, tribe by tribe. We've already done a few of the tribes, so in verse 31, we take up with the tribe of Asher. And so this is the pattern that we're seeing. Asher did not drive out the inhabitants of Akko. Now, Akko is just north of the bay that is right there on the coast of Israel, just to the north of the little knob that represents Mount Carmel coming out into the Mediterranean. So Akko was a Canaanite city, obviously, because these guys were coming into Canaan, and those inhabitants were supposed to be run out and executed if they tried to stay. But the tribe of Asher does not do that in their tribal designated area. Or the inhabitants of Sidon. Now, I don't think that's the city of Sidon or Sidon up to the north, because that's not in Asher territory. I think we're talking about a different Sidon that was inside their territory. Or of Alab, or of Achzib, or Helba, or of Afik, or of Rehob. So the Asherites lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. So they did not follow through with what they were supposed to do. And this sets the stage for the trouble that follows them from the time of the judges forward into their history of uniting the kingdom of all these tribes. Verse 33. Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh. Now, that's not Beth Shemesh down in the south. This is the one up in the north. Or the inhabitants of Beth Anat. So they lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. Nevertheless, the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh and of Beth Anat became subject to forced labor for them. So they're compromising. They're allowing the Canaanites to stay, even though God said that was not allowed. And they are making them work as slaves within the land. And that's not an appropriate compromise. Verse 34. The Amorites, and that's just another branch of the Canaanites, pressed the people of Dan back into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the plain. Now, the region of Dan, as we've seen earlier, is just to the north of the tribe of Judah's territory, and just to the west of the tribe of Benjamin's territory. And that puts it to the west of Jerusalem, if you want to kind of get that into your mind. And a lot of Dan, well, I shouldn't say a lot, but about half of Dan was hill country. And the rest of it was the flatlands down on the Mediterranean coast. And the Canaanites down there actually had squadrons of chariots. And they wouldn't let the Israelis come down there. The Israelis were not depending upon God. And so because of that, they were losing the battles. And then they were giving up. So the Danite tribe has pretty much lost at least half of their designated territory to the Canaanites that are digging in and not allowing them to come down. Verse 35, the Amorites persisted in dwelling in Mount Heres. Now that's part of the hill country. Heres here is somewhere near Aijalon Valley, because that's mentioned next, and in Sha'albim. So it's not just the flatland, they are encroaching up into the hill country as well. And the hand of the house of Joseph rested heavily on them, and they became subject to forced labor. Now, the house of Joseph is just to the north of the Benjamin territory, Benjamin and Dan territory. So they're apparently also forcing some of these Canaanites not out of the country, but into labor situations. Verse 36, and the border of the Amorites ran from the ascent of Akrabim, that's over by the south end of the Dead Sea, from Selah and upward. So they've got way too much of the flat land and a little bit of the hill country that's surrounding the core area of the Israelis. If we were to plot it out on a map, the Israelis have kind of got control of right around Hebron, and then from there up past Bethlehem and a little bit to the west of there, and down along the coast of the Dead Sea, and then all the way up past where Jerusalem is, except they don't have Jerusalem, because that's under Canaanite territory, and then up past Bethel, which they're also having problems there, and then clear up past Shechem barely, and then all that hill country down into the Jordan Valley, particularly around Jericho. That's kind of the core central area that the Israelis have control of. And then the eastern side of the Jordan Valley, the annexed territories of the 2.5 tribes, that's kind of under their control. And then some places up in the hilly parts of Galilee. So there's Canaanite pockets everywhere. And this is causing a great deal of trouble. And God is not happy with it. And he lets them know through his angel that he's not happy with it. And that comes up in chapter 2 of Judges, verse 1. Now the angel of He Who Is went up from Gilgal. So Gilgal was the beachhead where they came into the promised land. And that angel went up to Bochim. Now Bochim is the name that this place gets later. And I'm not sure where Bochim is. It's somewhere in that hill country area that I was just talking about as being the core. It may have been near or another name for Shiloh, where the tabernacle is located. But let's listen to the message from God through his angel. He said, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you into the land that I swore to give to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall break down their altars, So that was the deal. God said, I'm going to give you a promised land, and I am going to take good care of you and bless you, but you must get the Canaanites out of there. They're under my judgment. You need to chase them out, and those that try to stay, you execute them, and you break everything that has to do with their worship centers. Get rid of it. Now, God goes on and says this, though. But you have not obeyed my voice. What is this you have done? So now, I say, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall become thorns in your sides, and their gods shall be a snare to you. This little passage right here, verse number 3, is God's message. I am not going to assist you anymore in clearing the land out of Canaanites. The deal's off. I will continue to be God and bless you as you bless me, but you have brought the curse upon yourself. Remember the whole blessings and cursings that we've talked about from the book of Deuteronomy, and then Joshua led in the blessing and cursing ceremony at Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. That's all starting to come to pass now. This is God saying, you chose, and now you're going to reap the harvest of that choice, which is, I'm not helping anymore. Verse 4, as soon as the angel of He Who Is spoke these words to all the people of Israel, the people lifted up their voices and wept, and they called the name of that place Bochim, which is weepers, basically. And they sacrificed there to the Lord. Now, that's one of my reasons for thinking that we're talking about Shiloh, where the tabernacle is that on this particular occasion, it wasn't a place of peace, but rather a place of crying because of their choices. Now, the next thing that comes up in the book of Judges is the death of Joshua, which parallels something that we have not yet come to in the book of Judges, or excuse me, the book of Joshua. So we're going to save that for when I think it occurred time-wise. There is another event that we've already mentioned, and it's tied in with something we were just talking about a moment ago, and that is that the tribe of Dan has given up on trying to occupy the majority of their tribal allotment. And so the story of how they went north and took over a city that had not been given to them as an allotment, that comes up as a sort of appendix in the book of Judges. And the reason I mention it as an appendix is because it is clearly out of chronological order with the rest of the book. And it may have been that a prophet felt that this book of Judges needed to also include this important story from early on in the story of the Judges. And the Holy Spirit prompted him to make sure that it was appended to the original book that had been written. So Judges chapter number 17, I believe, takes place after the Bochim story, which I believe happens sometime in probably within the decade or two after the Israelis had arrived in the Promised Land. More than likely, I think it comes in the 8th, 9th, or 10th year of time that they were in the Promised Land. But it also, I believe, comes before the death of Joshua, where we can see that things are falling apart. All the promise of this new generation being better than the last generation that perished in the wilderness is starting to unravel. So Judges chapter 17. There was a man of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Micah, which is a shortened form, I believe, of Micaiahu, which has the idea of who is like Yahweh, who is like he who is. He said to his mother, "The 1,100 pieces of silver that were taken from you, think stolen, about which you uttered a curse and also spoke it in my ears. Behold, the silver is with me. I took it." Now, this is before coined money. And so these are little chunks of silver. Possibly they're already starting to weigh them as chunks. And so this might represent shekels of silver. 40, 50 pounds worth of silver, if that's the case. Buying power, if we take the idea of a shekel here in the context as it's later valued, then we're talking about several years worth of wages. A lot of money. It disappears, and she utters a vow before God that if she can just get it back, she will devote it back to God. Well, her young man, her son, is the one that stole it. And so he comes to her and says, "Mom, I'm the one that took that money." And here's how weird it is already. His mother said, "Oh, blessed be my son by he who is." So he stole it from her or hid it from her. And when he returns it at her prompting of a vow before God, she says, "Oh, that's great. I'm glad that you're the one that took it." Verse 3, he restored the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother. And his mother said, "I dedicate the silver to he who is from my hand for my son to make a carved image and a metal image. Now, therefore, I restore it to you." What in the world is going on here? The Ten Commandments are exceptionally clear that there are to be no graven images made. And the whole golden calf incident should have reinforced that. You don't even make images that are supposed to represent Yahweh. And yet, she says, "You know what? I am so thankful to get this money back. I have already made a vow to God that some of it is going to be turned into a special image representing God." And she gives it to her son to do that. Verse 4. So when he restored the money to his mother took 200 pieces of the silver, so not the full amount, not even a huge chunk of the full amount, who made it into a carved image and a metal image. And it was in the house of Micah. So we now have a little idol. It's not very big because it's only a few pounds. And what does it look like? I have no clue. But it's supposed to represent he who is, which is a violation of the scriptural covenant of this time period. Verse 5, the man Micah had a shrine, so he had a special building. And he made an ephod, which is a very simple overgarment, like a vest that just drops over your head. And it's used by priests whenever they do their ministrations. So he made an ephod and household gods. So here we have some little teraphim, little figures that represent the different spirits of nature or the spirits that are in the environment around the house. The Romans, much later in history, they had little household gods that represented like the god of the hearth and the god of the well and the god of the dining room, I think, and things like that. Well, that's apparently something that was already going on here in Israeli history, that they thought that there were little bitty spirits around the household, around the homestead. And so he's added them to his little shrine building where the little silver image dedicated to he who is. And then he ordained one of his sons who became his priest. Again, the scripture was very, very clear that there was only supposed to be the one tribe functioning as the priests. And yet, here is Micah going backward to a time when each family kind of designated one of their sons to function as the priest of the family. And here's the explanation as to why this is happening. Verse 6, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now later, the king that seems to be in mind is the united tribal king, like Saul, and then after that, David and Solomon, who would keep things focused. But I think that the emphasis might be about who the real king is here. God. The Israelis are losing their commitment to God calling the shots. He is not their king. They apparently are their individual sovereigns. Everyone's doing what they feel like in their own eyes. When I used to teach the arrangement of the Old Testament to my students when I was teaching in Christian school, I said, Book of Judges, here's the theme. There was no king in Israel in those days, and everyone did as they saw fit in their own eyes, and that's not a good thing. I always added that last little commentary phrase, because it's true. Let's see how bad it is. Verse 7. Now, there was a young man of Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he sojourned here. Now, don't get confused by this. The guy is a Levite. He is not Judean. He is living in Judah, but he's not living in one of the Levitical cities. He's been living in Bethlehem, a few miles south of Jebus and a few miles north of Hebron. What he's doing there, don't know. Apparently trying to earn a living. And he's not doing a good job of it, so he decides to go on the road. Verse 8, the man departed from the town of Bethlehem in Judah to sojourn where he could find a place. He evidently passed through the tribal area of Dan, because when we're talking about the rest of this story tomorrow, the Danites know this guy later in the story. So he must have traveled through their territory, maybe worked with them for a little bit, and then moved on. As he sojourned, he came to the hill country of Ephraim to the house of Micah. Micah said to him, where are you coming from? He said, I'm a Levite of Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm going to sojourn where I may find a place. Micah said to him, stay with me. Be to me a father. That is, like an advisor to me, a spiritual advisor. And a priest, because he actually is a priest. He's not just a Levite. We're going to find out that he's tied into a priestly family. So, I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year. Now, that by itself is not very much, because if I'm correct, then we're talking about maybe 20 days' wages or so. But listen to the rest of the arrangement. And a suit of clothes, and your living. So he's offering to him room and board, and his own clothing, his own uniform, and I'll also give you about close to a month's wages every year that you can spend on whatever you want. So it sounds like a pretty good deal to him. So the Levite went in. And the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. And Micah ordained the Levite, and the young man became his priest and was in the house of Micah. And then Micah said, "Now I know that he who is will prosper me because I have a Levite as priest." So he's moved up in the world because he had started out having one of his sons being the priest of his little shrine with the silver image devoted to he who is from stolen silver. Now he actually has someone from the Levitical tribes, someone that's related into the priestly family. And the reason I'm saying that is because this guy, it turns out, is the grandnephew of the high priest Aaron, because he is the grandson of Moses and the son of Gershom. So this is a shocking thing, that after Moses and Aaron are out of the picture, one of their offspring, grandson, great-nephew, is willing to take money to serve as a priest in a shrine building away from Shiloh, away from where the tabernacle is, and be the priest of a private chapel with an idol. And it is absolutely shocking that this is going on so early in Israeli history. Chapter 18 starts with the phrase again, "In those days, there was no king in Israel." And in those days, the tribe of Dan, the tribe of the people of Dan, was seeking for itself an inheritance to dwell in, for until then, no inheritance among the tribes of Israel had fallen to them. Now, understand the phrasing here. They had received their tribal allotment. That had been done in the seventh year while they were in the country, but they hadn't bothered to occupy it. And that's where their problem begins.